Oh.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, the deal to repeal HB 2 collapses with accusations of duplicity flying in both directions. So what happened? Why? And what now? The outgoing governor cooperates with the legislature in a move to diminish the power of the incoming governor. Charlotte School of Law is at the center of another crisis. This time, the federal government cuts financial aid for students, alleging the school was misleading and dishonest. And the 2017 Charlotte mayor's race is off and running. Our roundtable of reporters is set to talk about those stories and more. And we are joined today by David Borax from WFAE News. Good morning. Welcome
Hello,
back.
Mike.
And Mary C. Curtis, a columnist for Roll Call is here and contributor to NBCBLK and WCCB News Rising. Good morning and welcome back.
Good morning, Mike.
And our power team of Erics has suited up. Eric Spanberg is senior staff writer at the Charlotte Business Journal, and Eric Frazier is editorial writer at the Charlotte Observer. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Good to see you. You can reach us through email at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. You can use the hashtag WFAE Roundup. Let's begin at the obvious place. And for the last time in 2016, let's talk about HB 2. Governor-elect Roy Cooper worked hard to encourage Charlotte City Council to repeal our original ordinance, the one that provoked the passage of HB 2, on the promise that if they did, the legislature would repeal that bill, but that didn't happen. So let's go through this step by step. After some lobbying by Cooper, the Charlotte City Council on Monday took a very surprising and unannounced step. What provoked that step? Simply Roy Cooper saying, I got a deal in Raleigh if you'll do this?
Yeah, pretty much. You know, what's interesting is, Mike, you wanted to go in chronological order. Let's start with the fact that Monday's meeting, we weren't even at a city council meeting. The event was the annual legislative briefing, basically, on what the local goals are for the upcoming legislative session. That came to an end, and then Mayor Roberts said to the city council, why don't we stick around and take care of a little more business? It was really that casual. So the interesting part to start it all off is that Dan Bishop, the man who wrote HB 2, was still in the room because he had been in there as part of the legislative delegation. So he's watching them as they take this surprise vote to repeal the ordinance. And then we got romper room started from there.
So how did he react to that?
You know, he really didn't. He just was kind of stone-faced, and he was there for a little bit after the vote, but he got out of there before any of us reporters could get to him because we were all descending on the mayor.
It's hard to go in in alphabetical order for this because of all the side tangents, but he was in the room. It turns out that they didn't repeal the entire ordinance. They repealed the portions of the ordinance that they thought were the sticky points for Raleigh. So obviously, if Dan was in the room, do you think he knew they hadn't repealed? Was there discussion of leaving certain parts of it out?
There was not anything publicly available that told us what they were voting on, so it wasn't really clear. I'm sure they read it. I wasn't at the meeting, but
so they just voted on whatever was on their piece of paper in front of them.
Yeah, well, and at one point when it started, LaWanna Mayfield, a council member, said, "Hey, are we going to get a chance to read this before we vote on it?"
Uh-huh.
So it was that much of a sort of snap decision or quick moving piece of business. The whole thing was just absolutely surreal. The other thing I want to mention real quickly, Mike, is that Ed Riggs, who's a Republican on council, has told me and plenty of others that there was no sort of, hey, we're going to hold this out to get one past them. He says that the city spoke to legislators in Raleigh and said, look, this is a little piece that will clean up some other things. Can we leave this in? And they were told, yes, you can leave it in.
So they did this on the promise that the governor would call the legislature into special session to repeal HB 2. It's exactly what the governor did. But on Tuesday night, everything began to unravel. Why?
Well, they said that it was because of that, that there were some of the pieces that hadn't gotten repealed in Charlotte ordinance, and that I guess either it was bad communication or bad faith or some combination of the two. Where the
trickery
Charlotte
was
City
the word
Council,
they used.
Yeah, I mean, something just got lost in the mix here, and you just wish that people on both sides could have been bigger and more adult than what actually happened. And if there was some sort of a breakdown in communication, How about just talk to each other and fix it, you know, yeah. instead well, of, you know.
But there's such a lack of trust on all sides that if everything doesn't go perfectly, and we're talking about human beings, everybody's going to see malevolence in the motives. And yeah. so we're going from a place where it from the beginning it seemed like this was not going to end well.
Hmm. Well, and so remember, though, that the council held a special meeting on Wednesday. So we get to Wednesday when the General Assembly is going to have its special session. The council held another session to get rid of the technicality that was offending some of the Republican
and
lawmakers.
That's because of a memo that came out at 1 o'clock in the morning from the legislature on Wednesday morning, Tuesday night, Wednesday
Correct.
Morning. They were working late into the night on this. And that memo essentially called them out for not repealing the entire thing. So they got together on Wednesday and repealed all of yeah. it, right?
And at that point, the General Assembly still is not in session. So Charlotte has abolished everything. Now, at the same point, sort of concurrently, the Republican caucus in the House had spent 4 or 5 hours debating on Tuesday night, okay, are we really going to repeal this thing? And so you start to see the breakdown. I mean, Mary's right. There's the mistrust. There's this issue with the technicality. But there was also a lot of internal dissension among the Republicans in the state legislature.
So, I think it's always been an open question whether there's actually enough support among the Republicans to repeal this. And
yeah.
I think we saw the answer was
yeah.
no.
I keep yeah. wondering, did Phil Berger, did he have the votes or not? That's a
yeah,
key question
that's a very
that I
good
keep
question.
Wondering about. And only he and the members of his caucus know that. But did he call them back into session or bring, well, I mean, McCrory called them, but did they come with Phil Berger knowing he did not have the votes? Because if they did, what was all that about?
Well, and then the other thing I wonder is,
he would have had the votes, would he not, had the Democrats voted yes, and the Democrats voted no on this.
Well, and remember, but, Mike, that
but they added something to that bill. So,
right, that's why they voted
yeah,
no.
And some of,
they
voted no. Some of the Republicans didn't even want to call it into session.
Yeah.
So from the beginning, if some folks were saying, well, we don't even need this, it's unconstitutional. So you saw there that they weren't even on the same page from the beginning.
So there were several opportunities, David Borah, in the past, over this past year, for Mayor Roberts and or the City Council to repeal the original Charlotte ordinance, and they refused to do it. What was the difference this time?
Well, you're right. So in May, this came up, and they didn't do anything about it. In September, again, they didn't do anything about it, and there were accusations at that time that it was related to the election and to make sure that Roy Cooper had this HB2 issue in his back pocket as something to help him get elected. So this time around, I talked to a couple of council members. They've actually been working on this for 9 months, ever since this all happened. Everybody's been looking for a way to defuse the situation. I think the mounting economic issues, you know, the lost jobs and tourism and all of that have been a big issue. The damage to the reputation of the state has really weighed heavily. And I think there was not everybody on the council, but some on the council felt like, let's try to get past this. Let's try to fix this. It's in our power to do this piece that they want. Let's do it and see what happens.
And Eric Spanberg, are we not facing a moment in time when these big leagues like the NCAA and the NBA have to start making decisions about future tournaments and games, and we're facing that deadline?
We are. And so I think, barring some sort of post-Christmas miracle, what we're going to see early in 2017 is a series of announcements from those very groups saying, guess what, 2017-18, any commitment we had in North Carolina, Charlotte will not be honored.
Now, this, I want to go back to this little piece that they left in when they did the first repeal on Monday, because even the city attorney, Bob Hageman, said that little piece being left on the table was not going to be a problem.
That ordinance being left in place had absolutely no effect on public accommodations or the restroom, locker room, or changing facility issue.
So what did that piece that they left in initially have in it?
Well, let's break this down. So the issue here is that the non-discrimination ordinance has several subsections, and HB2 specifically was concerned with the public accommodations piece, which includes the bathroom issue. So they did repeal that on Monday. What they didn't repeal was what's called the commercial part of the non-discrimination ordinance, and that concerns businesses that contract with the city and how they treat their vendors and customers. And so,
and that's not part of HB2?
That was not mentioned in HB2, and Bob Hageman's argument is that they knew, the legislature knew that we had this and that it was not addressed in HB 2, and he felt that it was not necessary the first time around to take that out, and that's what happened.
Okay. The city has insisted that it was not, and you alluded to this, Eric Frazier, they were not trying to play tricks. They say that they believe the portion they initially left on the books was not part of the HB 2 controversy, but the legislature obviously viewed this as an indication that Charlotte wasn't acting in good faith. Is that an understandable conclusion, or is it merely an excuse to wriggle out of what put forth as an agreement?
Yeah, I think there's some of both things going on there. I mean, on the one hand, you do have this situation where there is a obvious lack of trust and even a lack of respect, I think. Neither side really respects the other. And on part two of that, you do have a sizable contingent of the Republican caucus that just did not want to repeal HB 2, period.
Right.
And so this became – and you did have a situation where – there were things being said on social media that would have given, you know, members of the Republican caucus who are opposed to repealing HB 2 cause for pause. I mean, you had, I think Jennifer Roberts was saying to some people on social media,
yes.
And some Republicans reposted it, that she was saying, you know, this is about the long game, you know, like this isn't over, you know, and some council member or somewhere
in Durham, Charlie Reese
said they were going to pass, you know, the
similar
equivalent of the Charlotte ordinance.
As soon as they repealed.
And okay. So some of the legislatures, the Republicans were saying, well, once we get this done, we're going to have these ordinance popping up all over the state.
And see, this gets to the heart of the problem, because even if they had managed to have less of a disaster Wednesday than what they wound up with, you're just kicking the can down the road. The problem remains because it's not just a fight among parties. It's culture and geography and
rural versus urban.
And there are a lot of Republican legislators, particularly from the smaller, more rural areas, who firmly believe that this is a matter of public safety, despite all evidence to the contrary. They believe that, and they don't want to move off of this. And so that's the rub here that I don't really see a way out of, because they disagree. There's not really middle ground. And the other thing, the final point, Mike, I want to mention is, remember, if it goes to the Supreme Court, that's only the bathroom piece. If that ever happened, it doesn't solve the rest of it.
I know that we're a Dillon state. We keep hearing that from the legislature. And that they set,
hard rain's going to fall.
And they set the rules for everybody else in the state. All the municipalities have to follow their orders. I get that. But if the worry is that the instant they repeal HB 2, all the urban areas are going to pass their own version of the Charlotte Ordinance, doesn't that tell them something about what North Carolinians are thinking?
Well, they know what North Carolinians are thinking. They know that the polling shows that most people want HB 2 to go away. But we're just in a situation where I think a lot of it is that sort of cultural split, you know, where the lawmakers who support HB 2 are just looking at the people who voted them into office in their small rural areas and saying, I don't. Nobody I know wants HB 2.
And they're getting bombarded by emails and campaigns by folks like the North Carolina Values Coalition saying stay strong. And they see this too. And of course, they're going to get affected by that.
We're going to come back and talk about leadership, because if Roy Cooper is the person who brokered this deal along with Phil Berger and others, he put his neck out and he might have gotten it chopped off before he even took office. We'll talk about that when we come back in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Biggs Camera, committed to the needs of professional and amateur photographers since 1959, offering new and used cameras as well as full online printing services, rentals, and more. Details at BiggsCamera.com. You know, you see little red hearts around Valentine's Day everywhere because for centuries humans thought that the heart was the seat of the soul and the origin. Love and emotion. Of course, the real heart is the center of our being. As long as it's beating, we have a chance. And it beats about 2.5 billion times in a lifetime, if we're lucky. Now, we're going to take a fascinating journey through what we know about the heart with an evolutionary biologist on this program, Monday at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup, President-elect Trump continues to add to his top-level staff. Obamacare sign-ups are strong, despite the law's uncertain future, and North Carolina fails to repeal a controversial bathroom bill.
Diane Rehm's final News Roundup coming up at 10 after the local News Roundup on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup with David Borax from WFAE News, Mary C. Curtis, frequent contributor to NPR, roll call columnist and WCCB News Rising, Eric Spanberg, senior staff writer for the Charlotte Business Journal, and Eric Frazier, editorial writer for the Charlotte Observer. So, Roy Cooper got together with Phil Berger in the legislature, and also, I guess, behind the scenes at Charlotte City Council, and talked to several people to try to broker this deal, which looked like it was going to happen beginning on Monday. After the legislature failed to take action on this, he issued a statement blasting Democrats on the North Carolina Republican Party issued a statement blasting Democrats on city council and Roy Cooper for, and I quote here, lying directly to the people. They went on to say the HB2 blood is now stain-soaked on their hands, and theirs alone. What a dishonest, disgraceful shame.
Very subtle.
Roy Cooper and Charlotte Democrats. And that was before they met in special session.
Hyperbole much?
Yeah. So was it all over at that point? I mean, was that a clue that it wasn't going to happen before it even happened?
I think, and the statements that you saw from Phil Berger and Tim Moore, the Speaker of the House, on Monday and Tuesday, certainly portended that, you know, all was not calm as they got ready together.
So Phil Berger said that when it was discovered that Charlotte failed to repeal all of its ordinance, the deal was gone. But we repealed it before the session. So why didn't that placate?
That's what makes you question, you know, the sincerity of what he's saying there. Because the end result was still that by the time the legislature took this up, Charlotte had did what it promised to do. It was done.
Yeah, they were looking for an out.
And it looks like this really fell apart in the House because, again, you know, they
refused to vote, right?
Right. They refused to vote. And, you know, the way these things work, whether it's Democrats in power or Republicans in power, they don't like to call a vote unless, excuse me, the majority of their party is going to support it. So it's not that it couldn't pass. It's that you don't want to go in there and have, you know, X number of Democrats and then just a handful of Republicans when you're the Republican Speaker of the House.
So, but then that does call into question, then why did Phil Berger go ahead and do that knowing he didn't have the votes? I think it was because he wanted to try and do that thing that he did at the end where he bifurcated the question and had a vote on the moratorium and a vote on repealing HB2 because he wanted to be able to come out with a press release, which he did immediately afterwards, saying Democrats voted against
HB2. Right, Democrats don't even want to repeal
this.
There was a lot of that going on.
Yeah, I mean, he was talking about how brass-knuckled politicians the Democrats were. That was pretty.
Yes, it was pretty tough.
You know, there was an exchange in the Senate right at the end there. There was an exchange at the end in the Senate there between Floyd McKissick, the Democratic senator from Durham, and Phil Berger, in which they basically outlined their positions pretty clearly. And if you can find the video on this, it's really worth watching. But McKissick made the argument that HB2 is hurting North Carolina. It's time to get rid of it. But this is a guy that agreed to a deal. But this bill that they ended up getting, you know, basically gave with one hand and took away with the other, was the way McKissick put it. And we're talking about this provision that said there'd be a moratorium. So in other words, we're going to do away with this bill that makes it illegal for cities and towns to pass non-discrimination ordinances. Oh, but by the way, in this bill, there's a clause that says, but you're not going to pass any non-discrimination ordinances. So it's really – that was his position. And then Berger got up and said, well, you Democrats knew all about what was in this bill, and he accused Roy Cooper of lobbying the Democrats to vote against it after they had made a deal, and, you know, this does not bode well for the next 4 years.
So let's hear from people up in Raleigh here. State Senator Jeff Tarte from Cornelius talked about that moratorium that you're referring to and explained it this way.
One of the city council members from Durham had announced that as soon as HB2 is repealed, he's going to introduce the Charlotte ordinance. So we're going to have HB2.1 almost instantly. And the idea was, let's literally chill out, let's step back, reflect where we are, and then let's get a full work group, committee work, let's not do this in special session, midnight votes, all that needs to quit happening.
All sounds reasonable. Then State Senator Jeff Jackson from Mecklenburg County had a different take on the legislature's actions, agreeing with Roy Cooper, who said it was, I think, disgraceful.
We had a deal and they broke the deal. They were very clear they were going to fully repeal HB2, no strings attached. I mean, we can debate the pros and cons of a moratorium, and you know, we would welcome that debate. But the fact is that they broke the deal. They said that they would keep their word, and they didn't. On an issue like HB2, for them to expect us to roll over after they break their deal is unrealistic.
Now, Republican Senator Buck Newton made mention of the lunatic left of
yes,
the city of Charlotte.
Yes, he did.
And went on to say, quote, "I have no faith in the city of Charlotte, no faith that anybody on the other side at this point will act honorably and in good faith to find a way forward. The legislature, other members of the legislature, have accused Charlotte of being Lucy in Charlie Brown and snapping away the football at the last possible second, and Charlotte is accusing the legislature of moving the goal line." There is
a lot of football metaphors flying around.
There is real rancor and absolutely no trust in Charlotte, in Raleigh of Charlotte. Is the reverse also true?
Oh, well, yeah. Absolutely. Without a doubt. I mean, remember, the reason they said no the first two times on the local repeal was they didn't trust the General Assembly to repeal HB2.
Huh.
Well, mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I wonder how that happened. But, you know, when you're talking about those two clips you just played, The moment that struck me, two moments struck me. The first is, so Phil Berger came in, first said, let's have a six-month moratorium. Then he came in and said, no, I'm changing that. Mm-hmm. Let's make it the full long session of the legislature plus 30 days, which in essence is 7 or 8 months instead of 6 months. That's probably not going to cool the tensions.
Right.
Second thing is, Senator Jeff Jackson stood on the floor and said, Charlotte acted in good faith. When he said that, the Republicans burst out into laughter in the Senate. That shows you how divided these people are.
It seems like that's got to be job one going forward from here, is that these people have to get in a room together and at least start seeing each other as reasonable, rational human beings. Let's just get to that point, because we're not there. Each side thinks the other side is, they're the worst people ever. They're the scum of the earth, the dregs of humanity. How are you supposed to make a deal with anybody when that's how you see them?
And when you're demonizing these folks, these legislators, you're demonizing the folks they represent. So basically, the citizens of the state of North Carolina are looking at all this and saying, we are electing you to be leaders, and you're acting like children, and nothing is getting done, and you're having these special sessions that we have to pay for as taxpayers. And in the meantime, our state, the social, economic, and political view of it is just going down, down, down.
Mm-hmm. What does this do to the image? Because we had a moment in the sun where people who are who have been looking at North Carolina and disparaging it because of HB2 saw, well, okay, they've come to their senses in their outside point of view. And they're going to repeal this, and then we don't.
Yeah,
This is even worse, I think.
Yeah. It would have been better if this had just not happened.
And what's interesting about that is, whatever side you happen to be on in Raleigh, when that thing ended, everybody was in despair, because everybody knew that things had just gotten a whole lot worse.
Yeah. Phil Berger, the Senate leader, told reporters after the session, "I think Roy Cooper tried to do everything he could to sabotage a reasonable compromise." Is there any evidence that Roy Cooper tried to sabotage this?
Well, it depends how you define sabotage. I mean, Cooper would...
And reasonable compromise.
Right. Cooper, yeah, exactly. I mean, Cooper had said clean repeal, and the Republicans are interpreting, or at least speaking of clean repeal, that there would be this cooling off period. And, you know, before, there had been talk about a blue ribbon panel to negotiate and find a way to have a set of LGBT protections. I think when they dropped that panel and started going to the cooling off period, that's another area where things really fell apart, because then you get in the moratorium and one side says it's pragmatic and the other side says, well, you'll just keep extending it. And there we go.
Cooper held a press conference on Wednesday night saying that Republican leaders broke the deal and that what Republican lawmakers were trying to do was tack on something that wouldn't work. He was referring to that moratorium that we've all been talking about here. And obviously this is very political. All of this is politics. And Roy Cooper says that the legislative leaders didn't have the courage to bring their recommendations to repeal HB 2 out of committee for a vote because of wanting to placate their constituencies. If that's true, why call the special session? Why put everybody through this?
Which is a great question. That's a great question. Yeah. And another thing that's been said a lot, you know, sort of all the talk in the halls, there are a couple things. One is that Governor McCrory desperately wanted to end on a high note by being able to sign the repeal of HB 2. The other thing that you heard immediately after things fell apart was that some Republican lawmakers were a little concerned that Roy Cooper was about to sort of walk in and do a touchdown dance. I think what all this boils down to is what we've talked about here is that they don't trust each other.
Yeah.
Everybody thinks there is no good motive involved, and so they can't get anywhere.
Everybody wants to win is the other thing.
Absolute victory.
And it's become so personal instead of thinking about the public. And I think that's a big problem because there's money lost, jobs lost.
But they would tell you they are protecting the public. They're doing what the public wants them to do. So are we just looking at it from the wrong lens?
Well, Mike, it's the old Twain line. There's lies, damn lies, and statistics. And so, you know, on the one hand, Eric Frazier was over here talking about the voter polls against HB2 and some of those sentiments. But on the other side, you would hear, look, we have supermajorities. We as Republicans only lost one seat in one chamber and gained in the other. We have a majority of Council of State positions, so clearly the voters are with us. So, you know, it's all how you interpret these
and
things.
And some of that due to the gerrymandering, which is in the courts now. So we have all of our laws, it seems, and even our very elective districts are in the courts and hung up. And it looks like there might be some more elections in 2017. Mm-hmm. Are these folks protecting their seats?
Absolutely. Nobody wants to be primaried.
Everybody wants to be primaried. And on and on. How are we going to ever break this up?
Well, some believe that the people in Raleigh are simply waiting for the Supreme Court to take this up and make the decision for them so they can say, well, I didn't decide this. The Supreme Court decided this. Is there any basis to that, maybe?
Well, I just start from what I mentioned earlier, and I think people have to take note of this. These defections by the ACC and the NCAA and the NBA and these companies, it's really not about the bathroom portion of the bill. And the only aspect of HB 2 that is in the court system that even has the chance of being decided by the Supreme Court is defining gender in terms of public restroom use. You still have the problem of no protection for gay and transgender people. And so that is not going to be magically solved. And until it is, North Carolina is going to continue to be boycotted. So
they're
going
to have to figure out how to solve this. You're right.
There are no protections.
I don't know how they do it, but they're going to have to figure it out because
this is not an issue in North Carolina. It's a national issue. I mean, many states like North Carolina, there is no legal protection for LGBT people. And, you know, that's something that even a moderate Republican like Jeff Tart says, you know, it's not really about transgenders in bathrooms. It's about getting our brains around the idea of putting protections into the law for LGBT
people. The problem, as you know, is that North Carolina is now ground zero. North Carolina is going to be in the spotlight, the brightest,
right,
as long as this issue goes
on.
So
what about the politics of city council not sticking to its guns? They repealed this ordinance. So even though it had no force of law because it was overruled by the legislature, they backed down.
Yeah.
Is that going to be
– looks bad for them. I mean,
get ready for the mayor's race.
They almost look like they got punked by the legislature.
And initially, did they not put a clause in that said, we're repealing this until December 31st. If they don't act on repealing HB 2, it goes back into effect even though it has no force of law.
Right.
They repealed that part of it. So now what?
Now they have nothing, and they have no recourse to do anything.
Because they can't pass a new one.
Yes. I hate to mention the dreaded Dillon State words, but the legislature has all the power here, and so there will be no ordinance that will be restored, even though the ordinance has been nullified. I feel like I'm doing Abbott and Costello.
Yeah.
Here.
Yeah. And LGBT citizens are probably looking in Charlotte and saying, well, we really don't appreciate our rights being a political football.
Yeah.
And I don't think even a lot of people in the state realize that businesses and so forth can basically refuse to serve or discriminate against LGBT folks.
I don't know if anybody on the panel knows this, but maybe you do. Was there anything comparable to this in the civil rights era? This political certainly there were people against giving civil rights to African Americans and giving voting rights to African Americans. But was there anything like this, which just went back and forth and back and forth, and it was so blatant.
Well, I don't know if there's a specific thing I can think of, but I mean, in general, yeah. I mean, you had a lot of bartering, horse trading. You think about all the things that Lyndon Baines Johnson did, you know, all the backroom deals and the.
Yeah, but backroom, you know, we didn't see the sausage.
Well, that's true. That's true.
But also, there's always pushback. And you saw it even after the Fair Housing Act said you couldn't have these restricted covenants and deeds in Charlotte, North Carolina, like in the neighborhood where I live now. You still had socially, when people moved in, there was pushback.
Right.
And so, yeah.
Yeah, whenever, culture again. Yes, yeah. I mean, a culture, you know, in terms of people saying, well, it's too early.
Yesterday.
Yeah.
Yesterday, the North Carolina branch of the NAACP announced plans to request the national NAACP to originate an economic boycott of the state. They did this in South Carolina over the Confederate flag. Did it work? Does this kind of thing have any impact?
It has an impact.
Is it going to have more of an impact than the removal of the NBA All-Star game and the NCAA championships?
Well, I mean, I think it would compound what's already pretty much effectively a boycott that's already going on of North Carolina.
Is the NAACP likely to go to do what he wants them to do?
I would think the chances are good. I would think. I don't
know. It'd
be
another voice added to the many voices that are already saying we don't like this.
Now, Mike, on the flip side, I want to mention State Senator Bob Rucho, who is retiring at the end of this month, but has been a very influential player in state politics. He stood on the floor Wednesday and said to the Democrats, look, this whole economic argument is just hogwash. North Carolina is still ranked as one of the best places to do business. He's speaking as a Republican. He said, we have reduced unemployment. We've reduced taxes, so on and so forth. Now, I'm not saying you should agree with that, but I'm saying, again, this is an example of they're on separate planets on this issue.
He's right about all of that, but all of that is also happening nationally as well. So
exactly.
It's not like North Carolina is this oasis in the middle of despair.
And you also might say, you know, we don't know the businesses you are losing, the conventions that aren't even considering Charlotte and considering cities in North Carolina. So.
I mean, going back to Republican Senator Buck Newton when he made mention of the lunatic left of the city of Charlotte yesterday, William Barber from the NAACP said, some people like to say this is Democrat versus Republican, but this is extremism. This is a party that's been hijacked by extremists who are afraid they cannot win if things are fair. We're not supposed to pass unjust laws that hurt the poor and hurt children and hurt women. It's wrong. So each side is calling the other extremists.
Well, and again, I want to emphasize, you also have there is a schism within the Republican Party, because you have Jeff Tart and others who are from the major urban areas who tend to be more of your sort of business minded politicians, and then you have others in the Republican Party who are much harder line on this and just say it's a matter of public safety, we're not doing it. And so that's where the first part of the problem begins before we get into the rest.
Well, there were actually other things that happened this week, including the diminishing of gubernatorial power and the Charlotte School of Law finding itself in another hot water kettle, and a visit by our new school superintendent, which we'll all talk about when we come back in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Gardner Webb University, a private Christian liberal arts experience dedicated to preparing students for success around the corner and around the world. Ignite your future at gardner-webb.edu. Well, we're in the middle of the local news roundup here, but coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show, it's Diane Rehm's final news roundup. President-elect Trump continues to add to his top-level staff. Obamacare sign-ups are strong despite the law's uncertain future. And, of course, they're going to be talking about North Carolina's failure to repeal the HB2 law. That's coming up on the final Diane Rehm Show as she prepares for retirement. Actually, she retires today at noon. So please join her right here.
All.
The end.
entire order.
Total number, amount, or quantity.
Or quantity.
Everything.
Complete.
Full.
Thorough.
Things.
Entities, ideas, or quality.
Quality.
Objects or facts.
Facts.
News or information.
Or information.
Considered.
To have thought carefully about.
Carefully about.
Taken under advisement.
Advisement.
Regarded.
Regarded.
Studied.
Or looked at.
Or looked at.
All Things Considered. From NPR News.
I'm Mark Rumsey. Tune in for All Things Considered weekdays beginning at 4 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, the local news roundup with Eric Frazier, editorial writer of the Charlotte Observer, Eric Spanberg, senior staff writer for the Charlotte Business Journal, Mary C. Curtis, columnist for Roll Call, David Borax, reporter for WFAE News. When Pat McCrory became governor, he asked, I believe, he asked the legislature for and received an expansion of gubernatorial powers. But on Monday, he signed into law a bill that would diminish the authority of his incoming Democratic successor. David Borax, what's good for the goose is not good for the gander?
You know, the Republicans have passed this because they can, number one. And they claim that, you know, this is something that Democrats did for years and years when they were in power. And so they passed a couple of bills that will limit the powers of the incoming governor.
Well, some say this is blatant hypocrisy on the part of Pat McCrory, but he didn't call for the legislation, I don't believe, nor did he vote to pass it, but
he signed
it. He did not have to sign it.
Why would he sign it?
Remember, his whole campaign was about changing the culture in Raleigh.
Right, so why would he sign it?
That's a good question.
It would have passed without his signature.
Love to hear the answer.
Why participate?
Yeah. Maybe that's just the bitterness over losing, and you say, you know what, I don't want my successor to have a good chance of success. I mean, I'm guessing. I don't know the reason.
It's not as though he went willingly. He fought it every step of the way, and he probably figures he's lost some friends in Charlotte anyway.
National pundits have called this legislative maneuver a GOP coup aimed at nullifying Cooper's victory over Pat McCrory. Is that what it is?
Well, I know they have, if it is or isn't, I know they've taken a real pounding nationally over that particular, you know, the diminishing of Roy Cooper's power. I was reading an editorial in the Wall Street Journal, of all places, that was basically saying, yeah, you guys, you Republicans in North Carolina, you're kind of overplaying your hand. And that's not, that's by no means
but this
a
has
liberal
happened. This has happened before. It happened to Jim Hunt. It happened to Jim Martin. When the legislature complexion changed, their powers changed.
But for those of us who are parents, I don't think you ever like to hear your children say, but they did it.
They did it.
That's the great third grade defense, is they did it too. And even folks who are looking at it and parsing it, saying it didn't go this far, basically. And the whole thing of the election boards, where now it's even and the Democrats are in charge on the years when they don't have elections, it seems so incredibly petty.
So what powers did Governor-elect Cooper lose that Governor Pat McCrory has?
Well, for one thing, he lost two-thirds of his appointments.
Right.
Two-thirds? Wow.
Yes.
It went from 1,500 to 400?
Well, when McCrory came into office, they gave him additional appointments that weren't there before, and then now they've taken them back again and reduced Cooper's numbers. The other thing is that – and this is – it's in the state constitution that the legislature can have oversight of the governor's cabinet appointments, but North Carolina had never enacted that. Well, now they've decided to pull that
string.
But
isn't that exactly how it's done in Congress?
When
Donald Trump puts his cabinet forth, the Senate will have to approve or not.
So now it's like, why now? And the reason why now is because we can. And there is an element of these bills that in which the Republican-controlled legislature is saying, we're in charge here, and we just wanted to remind you of that.
Yeah. Yes, yeah. And also the UNC Board of Trustees. I thought, you know, that's very interesting. Remember all of the fights that have gone on during the past 4 years over the trustees and the direction of higher education? That's a notable move as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Also the elections, because we have already been in trouble as a state on our voting bill, which was said to be unconstitutional, and it went after minority voters with almost surgical precision.
Right.
And so now, you know, the election boards, when they had majority Republicans, were doing things like reducing the number of places where you could vote, the polling places, and cutting early voting hours. So it was very political. And now they're saying, okay, but the Democrat won't have charge of this lever, which is voting. And so that looks pretty bad, too, when you're already in trouble for your voting laws.
Governor McCrory said that he had come to realize, and this is a quote, come to realize that the current changes to executive authority in House Bill 17 have been greatly exaggerated by misleading TV ads, paid protesters, and state and national media outlets. Again,
who writes this stuff?
He just gets smaller and smaller on his way out the
it's
door.
It's a wonder he won't say outside agitators. Well,
is there any truth to the fact that the media is the bad guy here? Or that we're getting it wrong? Or that we're being unfair? Is there any truth to that? Let's a little navel-gazing, guys.
A little navel-gazing.
Gals.
I don't think so, but then again, I think the governor and others would say that I'm biased because I'm part of the media. I mean,
evil media.
I mean, you know, I think that what the media wants, what most of us want, are stories. It's not that we're really pulling for one side or another.
True.
We're trying to find out what the tension is, what the breaking points are, what's working and what's not working. And no politician, Democrat or Republican, likes that. Mm-hmm. People don't like that. In general, people are pretty thin-skinned. They don't like to be called Pat.
I'm in favor of drama.
Pat McCrory has sat at this table and talked to me after he's been on this program and complained about the media.
Oh, he did it when he was mayor. Forever.
And I said, give me an example. A couple of times, I said, give me some examples. And he will go into a story that has been reported on, and he'll give me some interesting information that I didn't hear reported on. Well, the problem is we don't know it. So if you'll tell us, maybe we'd report on it, right?
Absolutely. And I'll tell you another thing, because I covered McCrory as mayor for years. And I remember after he left office, he started doing this public affairs show, and he would talk all the time about voter fraud and how the media was missing the story on voter fraud. Mike, I can't even tell you how many nonpartisan stories have proven nationally, locally, statewide, there is not an epidemic of voter fraud. It's a minuscule problem, if a problem at all. And so, you know, some of this just comes down to partisan viewpoint, not factual reporting.
And we seem to be living in a time where people are trying to tear down the institutions that make all of this work. I mean, you have politicians saying that government is the problem. You have politicians pointing fingers at the media. But the media, does the media point back? Is anybody in the media pushing back?
You mean institutionally?
At saying that.
Well, I mean, we've been in lawsuits with McCrory for at least a year now.
I mean, and not just him. Let's broaden down. Not just Pat McCrory.
But we do, as the news media, we do use the courts to enforce what we think are our rights under the law to get information. I mean, the biggest issue here is that we reporters are just like anyone else. We hate a vacuum. When there's an information vacuum, we're going to flood in there and ask questions and raise questions that may point fingers, and that's what creates problems like this.
And the other thing is that media is so, you know, it's so, I don't mean divided ideologically, it's just there's so much media and so many different forms of media that lumping all of it together is very difficult.
Yeah, because media includes Saturday Night Live and the Samantha Bee Show.
Exactly. Okay.
And also even on cable shows, they mix reporters with pundits that have points of view, and now everyone really confuses everything.
Right.
And so folks can say, don't believe the media, believe what I'm telling you. So we're in a fact post-fact zone, I would say.
Okay, well, let's talk about some facts here. Charlotte School of Law was notified by the American Bar Association of noncompliance in February and July of
this
year.
That's a fact.
And placed on probation over concerns that unqualified students were being admitted and that too many graduates weren't passing the bar exam. Now, the U.S. Education Department has cut financial aid effective December 31st, saying that the for-profit school is misleading and dishonest. These two cases are connected? Are they?
Which two cases?
Well, the ABA saying you're in noncompliance and the Education
yes.
Department.
Oh, yes, yes, absolutely. Sorry. Yes, yes. Uh-huh. Sorry, you stumped the jury there for a minute. I'm sorry.
So they're totally connected. I mean, it's the ongoing issues at the school are what is prompting both the American Bar Association to raise questions, and that's what prompted the Department of Education to act.
And the Observer reported this morning that the dean of the Charlotte School of Law had this same problem at another school of law where he was employed prior to this. It just recently came out, and the dean there now said, well, that happened in this time frame, and that's when this guy who runs the Charlotte School of Law was in charge.
It's a pretty bad situation. I mean, you have to really feel for any student who is currently trying to, you know, pursue a law degree, and, you know, you wonder if you've even got firm ground underneath you, and if your law degree will mean what?
Yeah.
Will it
well,
work
and,
they,
and you've racked up all
on?
These debts,
yeah,
with the loans,
yeah.
And their placement the rates problem. Were already yeah. their placement rates were already low.
Well, yeah. The Department of Education stated that the Charlotte School of Law made substantial misrepresentations to current and prospective students tied to its accreditation status and the likelihood graduates would pass the bar exam. So, are they saying that they don't properly prepare students?
Or that is one of the things they're saying. Here's the thing. Okay. This is a business, and we need to remember that. I think if you want to go down to the bottom line here, this is a for-profit company that is selling legal education. And, you know, in 2016, 37% of first years dropped out for academic reasons. So that makes you think they're just admitting too many people here. And why are they admitting too many people? Well, they're a business. They're paying customers.
And not only that, David.
Or they're getting federal aid.
They're getting $50 million a year from the federal government in student aid. And so when you take that money away, then the question becomes, how do they stay in business?
And they exist. Yeah. And this company that runs this law school has been in trouble in other ones.
So this is the state's largest law school, as I understand it. What will this mean for students? Because this came with no warning. At least some of the students say it came with no warning, and the financial aid ends.
Right. The big question is the school going to close? You know, some of the coverage this past week has raised the question, will they be able to reopen on January 4th or whenever the next term begins? And we're just not sure about that. And we're hearing from students that they don't know what to do. I mean, what if you're a second semester of your final year of law school, you're getting ready to graduate, you're on track, and the school might not be there? What happens to you? You can't transfer at that point.
And now you owe tens, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars. Yeah. Let's just say you finish. What is your? I mean, how tarnished is your diploma when you have all this going
and
on?
Much less your hope. You were very optimistic. You had this law degree, and now you have loans, and you may not even have a school degree.
One would hope that if you're a semester away from graduation, that you would have the wherewithal to sue the company that owns the school. Speaking of schools, the school board's choice to be the new superintendent of Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools, Clayton Wilcox, was chosen behind closed doors, as we all know. But he was here on Tuesday for his first visit since being chosen. But only one TV station, WBTV, was chosen to cover that visit. This is fascinating to me. They were chosen to cover the visit. Yeah. You mean other news outlets weren't permitted to be there?
That's I don't think the other news outlets knew that there was an opportunity.
Yeah.
I think that what happened now, I believe your colleague Ann Doss Helms had reported that the new superintendent would be here, but that was kind of all that was known. There was no press conference. There was no media availability, and they reached out to WBTV, and then I think they just threw the other numbers and emails away.
Because Clayton Wilcox was scheduled to be on this program this past Monday, and then last Friday said, I can't make it. My schedule won't permit it. And he was going to check with the school board to find out if they would let him be on this program. Evidently, that's the case. He wasn't allowed to be on the program.
Mike, he heard you were going to be too tough on him.
Andos Helms, the Observer's education reporter, says this is one more sign that the current school board is revamping the public process that has traditionally accompanied a national superintendent search. They said that the candidates in the selection process wanted it to be private, and there's some truth to that, probably, because they didn't want their current employers to know they were looking for a job. But why, now that the selection has been made, why shut down access?
CMS said that this visit to the schools this week was only one news outlet because they didn't want it to be a media circus. And I get that. I mean, you know, when there's a big event like that, there's like 10, 15, 20 reporters, TV cameras, and all that. So I get that. But my point on this is, why not pool it? Why not say, all right, WBTV, you can be there, but you got to give tape to everybody else.
Yeah. Well, board member Rhonda Lennon said that the board wanted to make sure, this is a quote, wanted to make sure the public could see and hear more about him, and that the WBTV story would afford that opportunity because of their broad audience, both on the air and social media.
They felt that reporter was going to be friendly to them. Let's put it.
I don't. I was going to say, I don't want to point out ratings or things like
here
that.
But, you defend know. Himself.
Well,
yeah. So.
Well and I'm not.
I'm not sure he had anything to say about it.
any reporter. anyone sitting here or anywhere else that says they would turn down an exclusive offered, I mean, that, of course you're going to take it. So I don't blame
him.
Good
point. Good point.
I don't blame him at all. I blame them for not having the sense on how to coordinate their media policy.
But when the watchwords in a community, it's trust and transparency.
Right.
This is, and there are a lot of questions about the schools right now, and they're going to have a lot of challenges to meet. This is not a good way to start.
And I know we have, at The Observer, we've written, you know, some things that they may not have liked. And there's an open question in my mind as to whether or not some of that was, you know, some retaliation, kind of petty level retaliation. You know, I know we had written at the editorial board an editorial questioning this weird deal with a milk study, a study about chocolate milk that was supposed to help people,
help
athletes to not have concussions in Maryland there that Clayton Wilcox was involved with, and you know there was a lot of questions about whether they had done they had handled that the right way because it was a school system dealing with a private a study, and that there were athletes, high school athletes, who were involved, and did they get proper consent from the parents and all
and,
that
and stuff. His statements were contradictory, his public statements were contradictory,
and they were contradictory, and we raised some of those questions. And
here's the other thing,
Mike.
We
didn't get to cover him.
Well, they're not going to go away, those questions.
Here's the other thing, Mike. Why not just have a day where he's at the school without any media and then do the other day with a typical media circus? This is not that hard to figure out.
Yeah.
This is just clumsy.
We have other topics to talk about, but we have no more time left. And I want to say thank you and give a fond farewell to Eric Frazier here, who, because he's leaving The Observer at the end of the year, is also leaving the Charlotte Local News Roundup.
Yeah.
We're sorry to see you go. Where are you going, Eric?
Oh, thanks, Mike. I'm thank you for that warm goodbye. But I'm going to the Duke Endowment. I'm going to be their digital communications strategist, helping them to beef up their online and social media presence. And it's been a great run. I've really enjoyed being a part of the Friday News Roundup. This is a great opportunity, and moving on.
Well, we wish you well. Happy holidays. Merry Christmas. Happy New Year. Good luck in the new job. Is there anybody left at The Observer?
Yes, there are plenty of people left.
Oh, there are more people sitting at the table here who used to work there than work.
That's Mary C. Curtis for Expand.